Hey guys, Horror Fan here, and welcome back to my podcast on Anchor. Today, I'm going to be doing the horror talk of Larry Ayler. If you guys ever heard of him, great. For those of you who never heard of him, Larry William Ayler, born December 21st, 1952, died on March 6, 1994. He was an American serial killer believed to have murdered a minimum of 21 teenage boys and young men in a series of killings committed in the Midwest between 1982 and 1984. So 40 years ago, similar to Jeffrey Dahmer, but literally so different. convicted and sentenced to death by lethal injection for the 1984 kidnapping and murder of 16-year-old Daniel Bridges. He later voluntarily confessed to the 1982 murder of 23-year-old Stephen Egged, offering to also confess to his guilt in 20 other unsolved homicides if the state of Illinois would commute his sentence to life imprisonment without parole. Ayler died of AIDS-related complications in 94 while incarcerated on death row. Shortly before his death, he confessed to the murders of 20 further young men and boys to his defense attorney, Kathleen Zellner. However, he denied being physically responsible for the actual murder of Bridges, which he insisted had been committed by an alleged accomplice in five of his homicides, Robert David Little. With her client's consent, Zellner posthumously released Ayler's confession following the formal announcement of his death. Ayler was known as the interstate killer and the highway killer because many of his confirmed and alleged victims were discovered across several Midwestern states in locations close to or accessible via the interstate highway system. So yeah, he was born in Crawfordsville, Indiana, died at the age of 41 years old at Pontiac, Illinois, U.S. He had other names, the highway killer and the interstate killer. He was 6'1". His parents were George Howard Ayler and Shirley Phyllis Kennedy. His motive was actually rage, which is uncommon for a serial killer. So what that I did on my Horror Talk podcast, because normally their motive would be money or protecting them from the devil or something else. But with rage, that's actually the first time ever, which is like really, really crazy. Convicted in Illinois, murder, aggravated kidnapping, concealment of a homicidal death, and Indiana murder. Criminal penalty in Illinois, death October 3, 1986. Then Indiana, 60 years imprisonment on December 28, 1990. His victims was between 21 and 24. He did this set of crimes beginning October 23, 1982, then finished August 19, 1984. So this was 40 years ago. That's crazy. 40 years, which he started to kill. In the U.S., the states he did was in Illinois, Indiana, but there were two alleged states he did, Kentucky and Wisconsin. He was apprehended on August 21st, 1984, 2 days after his bed of crime was finished. He was imprisoned at the Pontiac Correctional Center. Before I get on to the horror talk of Larry Ayler, don't forget to follow me on Anchor and Spotify. Let's get on to Ayler. Okay, 1 second, sorry. Okay, so Ayler was born on December 21st, 1952, in Crawfordsville, Indiana, the youngest of four children born to George Howard Ayler, born September 19, 1924, died September 25, 1971. Oh my god, he died six days after his birthday. Holy shit, I didn't know that. That's crazy. Oh, and Shirley Phyllis Kennedy, born April 22, 1928, died June 8, 2016. She died 6 years ago. Holy crap. His father was an alcoholic known to have physically and emotionally abused his wife and children. Ayler's parents divorced in mid-1955, and he and his sister were regularly placed in the care of babysitters, foster families, or simply left in the care of their two older siblings, the oldest of whom was aged 10, as their mother struggled to financially support and provide adequate care for four children, working two jobs as a waitress and in a factory on weekdays and occasionally in a bar on weekends. Not surprising. I mean, usually, like, there'll be mothers who would struggle and they would, like, work in bars or, like, strip clubs or that. No offense about that, but probably. Nonetheless, when Ayler and his sister were in the care of foster families, their mother would frequently visit her two youngest children, and Ayler would claim these separations and reunions brought the family closer. Well, that's nice. In 1957, Ayler's mother remarried, but this marriage lasted 1 year before the couple divorced. His mother married for a third time in 1960, although the couple divorced 4 years later. She married for the fourth time in 1972. Ayler's father and his first two stepfathers drank heavily, and he and his siblings were subjected to frequent abuse, with one of his stepfathers frequently holding Ayler's head beneath scalding water as a form of discipline. Jeez, so he did not have a good relationship with his dad and stepfathers. I'm not sure about the fourth one. Maybe he was not an alcoholic, but who knows. So Ayler, Ayler attended St. Joseph's School in Lebanon, India, tall for his age and active in sporting activities. He was regularly targeted by bullies due to his being from a low-income family and his parents' divorce, frequently leading to his sister Teresa confronting her brother's tormentors. I think he is close to his sister Teresa. Teachers viewed Ayler as a quiet yet likable pupil with a few friends. Due to his increasing stubbornness and erratic behavior, Ayler's mother placed him in a home for unruly boys in 1963. Oh my god. He found this experience emotionally devastating, and within weeks had tearfully persuaded his mother to allow him to return home. Shortly after that, Ayler underwent psychological tests, which revealed him to be of average intelligence, although suffering from severe insecurity and extreme fear of separation and abandonment. Deducing these fears from his home life, staff recommended Ayler be temporarily placed in the Catholic boys' home in Fort Wayne. He remained at this residence for 6 months before returning to his mother's care. Then adolescence and early adulthood. So similar to Jeffrey Dahmer, of course, Ayler discovered he was homosexual when he reached puberty. He was open about his sexuality only to his family, which is actually good. But although he struggled with deep-seated feelings of self-hatred regarding his sexual orientation, I think he was probably confused, at least he opened up to his family. But in some serial killers, like say with Jeffrey Dahmer, like, you know, they were homosexual, sometimes they don't know if they were gay or straight. It does happen to some serial killers besides Dahmer, but hold on, guys. Sorry. Okay. Throughout high school, he occasionally dated girls, although none of these relationships became physical. Having been somewhat religious since childhood, Ayler did confide to some close acquaintances about how he struggled to accept his sexuality. In part due to his lackadaisical attitude towards schooling, Ayler failed to graduate from high school, although he did later obtain a GED, or General Educational Development Certificate. Shortly after leaving college, Ayler obtained employment as a private security guard in the Marion County General Hospital. He worked in this employment for 6 months before losing this position and finding alternate work within a shoe store. While in this employment, Ayler began familiarizing himself with Indianapolis's gay community, frequently gay bars, and frequently engaging in casual liaisons with men. Now, that's like not unlikely something happened, but that's like it does happen, of course. Wait, what? Several of these individuals noted Ayler averted his eyes from his partner during intercourse while shouting profanities such as bitch and whore, leading many to believe Ayler was fantasizing his partner was female. Okay, but then the paraphilia. By the mid-1970s, Ayler was well known within the gay community of in Indianapolis, particularly among those with a leather fetish. I mean, I know about the leather fetish because I have a best friend who's gay and he has a harness, honestly, but I don't think he has a fetish towards that. Also, fetish. I was saying something about that. Several acquaintances with this community described him as a good-looking, laid-back guy, an avid bodybuilder close to his mother and sister. However, others who had engaged in sexual activity with him described him as an individual with a sadistic streak and violent temper, which would only surface within their sexual encounters, often involving Ayler extensively bludgeoning, then inflicting light knife wounds upon unwilling partners, particularly to their torsos. Wow, that's like not kidding. Ayler primarily worked as a house painter, and although never having served in the military, he was fond of wearing Marine Corps t-shirts. He resided in a condominium in Terre Haute with a 38-year-old library science professor named Robert David Little, whom he had first met in 1974 while studying at the Indiana State University. Oh, wow. The relationship between the two men was platonic, with Ayler viewing Little as a father figure. Ayler and Little regularly socialized within Indianapolis's gay community. Although Little, a socially awkward, tactium, and unattractive individual, typically struggled to form friendships or obtain sexual partners during these excursions. Ayler frequently brought young men to Little's home to engage in sex with the two. Now, the first attempted murder. On August 3, 1978, Ayler picked up a 19-year-old hitchhiker named Craig Long on 7th Street in Terre Haute. Shortly after Long entered the pickup truck, Ayler propositioned the youth, resulting in Long attempting to leave the vehicle. Ayler pressed a knife against the youth's chest as Long stated, quote, "I don't have any money," end quote. Ayler then drove towards a rural field, stating, quote, "It's not your money I want. I'm not after your money," end quote. He then ordered Long to undress before he handcuffed the youth, bound his ankles, and ordered him to climb into the back of the pickup. When Long attempted to flee from the pickup as Ayler undressed, Ayler chased after him as Long shouted, quote, "You queer," end quote. In response, Ayler stabbed the youth once in the chest, penetrating his lung. Long, his lung. Craig slumped to the ground, feigning death. He later stumbled to a nearby house where the occupants summoned paramedics. Shortly after, Ayler drove to the house as Long, as Craig received first aid and offered the handcuff key to a sheriff's deputy, claiming he had stabbed the young men accidentally. He was arrested and taken into custody. A search of his vehicle recovered a hunting knife, a metal tipped whip. Wait, a metal tip? Where the hell you get that? A butcher knife, a further set of handcuffs. Oh, that's like not surprising. Tear gas and a sword. Whoa, where the hell you got that sword from? Ayler was later charged with aggravated battery, to which he agreed to plead guilty. A judge set his bond at $10,000, a sum raised by friends. He was released on bail until August 23. On this day, Ayler's lawyers offered Craig a check from Little for $2,500 in return for his agreeing not to press charges. Craig, of course, accepted the offer, and Ayler changed his plea to not guilty. As such, he was acquitted on November 13, being fined $43 in court costs. This is what journalist and author Gera or Jera Lynn Corlock reflecting on Ayler's abduction and stabbing of Craig Long in 2015. Quote, "His urges got to him. He wasn't realizing what he was doing. He was fantasizing. He learned on that case not to let them be alive anymore because they can't come back. He learned to kill them, end quotes. Now, a long-term relationship. In August 1981, Ayler formed a long-term relationship with a 20-year-old married man named John Dobrovolskis. I'm so sorry, wait, 20 years old and a married man? Oh, jeez. Dobrovolskis lived with his wife, two children, and three foster children on North Greenview Avenue in Chicago, Illinois. His wife, Sally, was tolerant of her husband's sexual orientation and that her husband's lover also often lodged with them on weekdays, paying a third of the rent. So basically, he was bisexual, I guess. Ayler and Dobrovolskis held a penchant for sadomasochism, and their sexual activity frequently involved Ayler binding his partner to devices before proceeding to beat and lash him as he hurled curses at Dobrovolskis before the two engaged in penetrative sex. Although neither Ayler nor Dobrovolskis was inclined towards monogamy, the couple considered their relationship permanent. I think monogamy, I got it from psychology class, sorry about that. It's a form of dyadic relationship in which an individual has only one partner during their lifetime, alternately only one partner at any time, as compared to non-monogamy. The term is also applied to the social behavior of some animals, referring to the state of having only one mate at any one time. So I don't think his wife was like involved with that shit, so probably, yeah, no offense. Okay. Nonetheless, Ayler constantly sought assurance he was only man in his lover's life, and the two are known to have frequently argued over Ayler's accusations of his lover's infidelity, really. These arguments occasionally led to Dobrovolskis striking Ayler, who never retaliated in these physical altercations. Occasionally, the couple's arguments were initiated by the perceptions and recriminations of Robert Little. He made no secret of his intense dislike of Dobrovolskis to Ayler and resented the fact he was in a long-term relationship. I think there might be like a jealousy between Little, because I think I think he had a crush on Ayler because of how, like, he disliked Dobrovolsky so much and how Little wanted to be with Ayler. But I don't think Ayler never knew that Little had a crush on him. I'm not sure exactly, but that's my opinion, so. Although Ayler primarily and intermittently worked as a house painter in Illinois on weekdays, he also worked as a liquor store clerk in Greencastle, Indiana on Saturdays. As such, he regularly traveled between the two states, living rent-free at Little's Terre Haute residence at weekends. And the murders. Between 1982 and 1984, Ayler is known to have committed a minimum of 21 murders and one attempted murder. All of his murders involved restraining his victim, and several victims were subjected to varying degrees of sadomasochism before being stabbed and slashed to death, with the majority of the wounds being inflicted on the victim's chest and abandoned. His victims were typically piled with alcohol and sedatives such as eth-chlorvinol before their restraint and murder. Several victims were disemboweled after death, and Ayler is known to have dismembered the bodies of four of his victims. Jeez! Great, he's really like Dahmer, but worse probably. Well, almost worse. His victims were typically discarded in fields close to major interstate highways, with their trousers and underwear frequently discovered and around their knees or ankles. Their shirts and wallets were missing from the crime scene. So on October 12th, 1982, Ayler lured a 21-year-old named Craig Townsend into his vehicle in Crown Point, Indiana. Although drugged and extensively beaten and later abandoned naked and unconscious in the rural fields, causing Townsend to also suffer from exposure, the young man survived this assault. Gee, so he is like the second person to survive because of Craig Long. So obviously, yeah. 11 days later, on 23rd, October 23rd, yeah, Ayler abducted and murdered a 19-year-old named Stephen Crockett. His body was discovered in a cornfield in Kankakee, in Kankakee County, approximately 12 hours after the murder. An autopsy revealed Crockett had been beaten, then stabbed to death, suffering 32 knife wounds, including four to his head. So, his first victim. 1 week later, on October 30, one day before Halloween, of course, a 26-year-old named Edgar Underkoffler disappeared from Roundsville, Illinois. His body was not discovered until March 4, 1983, a year later, in the fields close to Danville, Illinois. Sometime the following month, Ayler murdered a 25-year-old barman named John Johnson. His body was discovered 1 month later in Lowell, Indiana. On November 20, Ayler abducted a 19-year-old hitchhiker named William Lewis at a location close to Vincennes, Indiana. He was stabbed to death and buried in the field close to Rensselaer, Indiana. On December 19, a 23-year-old named Stephen Agan was abducted in Terre Haute. His body was discovered in woodland close to Indiana State Road 63 on December 28. An examination of the L building of an abandoned farm close to the crime scene revealed several traces of human flesh upon the walls and areas where the plaster had been damaged, leading investigators to speculate that Agan had been suspended against the walls of this property as his murderer had inflicted the injuries to his body. Noting the extensive mutilation upon Agan's abandoned chest and throat, the coroner who performed the autopsy, Dr. John Pless, referenced the tremendous rage Agan's killer had exhibited upon his victim in his autopsy report, adding a likelihood of there being more than one perpetrator in this murder. Immediately after concluding Agan's autopsy, Pless conducted the autopsy upon the murder upon the body of a 21-year-old named John Roach, whose body had been found close to Interstate 70 in Putnam County that day. Pless noted striking similarities in the injuries inflicted upon Roach and Agan, again noting multiple stab wounds to the victim's abdomen, upper chest, and throat, suggesting an overt rage exhibited by the perpetrator. I mean, I never did a horror talk where a serial killer had a motive for rage, because any serial killer motive would be just hatred for women or money or like something else. I mean, I'm not entirely sure, but the fact that Ayler did this just for rage, I mean, probably I in my opinion, listen guys, listen, I'm not a licensed doctor or a licensed psychiatrist. In my opinion, I believe he wanted to do this because maybe he had similarities of his stepdad and his real dad of all bit of them be alcoholics, and maybe he like took his frustration inside him to the murders he committed throughout the years. So that's my opinion. I'm not entirely sure. So yeah. On December 30, a year before New Year's Eve, a 22-year-old Yale University graduate named David Block disappeared from the Illinois suburb of Highland Park, having told his family of his intentions to visit a friend in the nearby city of Highwood. A farmer discovered his body in the field south of Illinois Route 173 on May 7, 1984, 2 years later. Holy shit, it's crazy. Yeah, I believe his body was decomposed, but I think the coroner did an autopsy and found out who he was, probably of like examining the teeth and all that stuff. 1983, on January 24, Ayler abducted and murdered a 16-year-old named Irvin Gibson in Lake County, Illinois. His body was not discovered until April 15, discarded atop a dog's body, which had also been stabbed to death. Oh my God, damn. Between March and April 83, Ayler is believed to have killed a minimum of five further victims, which between the ages of 17 and 29. On May 9, the body of 21-year-old Daniel Scott McNave was discovered in a field close to Indiana State Road 39 in Hendricks County. The wounds inflicted on McNave immediately tied his murder to other victims tentatively linked to the same perpetrator. He had suffered 11 knife wounds to his neck, 5 to his back, and 11 to his abdomen, with one wound causing sections of his small intestine to protrude through his abdomen. Furthermore, welt marks were discovered on McNeese's wrists and ankles, and his jeans have been pulled down to his ankles. As with other victims, McNeely's body bore no signs of his being subjected to a sexual assault. Ayler murdered a 25-year-old named Richard Bruce in Effingham, Illinois, 9 days later. His body was thrown from a bridge into a creek and remained undiscovered until December 5. Oh, wow. I'm surprised that Ayler did not have like a camera to take Polaroids because I mean, with Dahmer, he had a Polaroid and he wanted to like take pictures of his victims' bodies to have memories or some shit. But with Ayler, it's like so different, honestly. Many advocates within Indiana's gay community had speculated the sudden increase in the number of disappearances and murders of young males might be the work of a single perpetrator by early 83. Although police had routinely raided gay bars and bookstores, and in addition to continually or overly filming patrons of these premises in their efforts to identify the movements of suspects, that month the gay newspaper The Works, in their own efforts to assist police, created an anonymous telephone hotline and published an article speculating as to both the identity and motive of the perpetrator, whom they speculated struggled to accept his sexuality. That is the case, yes. With assistance from members of the gay community and the family of one murder victim, the editors of the newspaper offered a reward of $1,500 for any information obtained leading to the arrest and conviction of the killer. By the early spring of 83, police in Indiana had tentatively linked several murders of young males committed in the state to the same perpetrator. 6 days after the discovery of McNeese's body, the Indiana State Police conducted a meeting attended by 35 detectives from each of the four jurisdictions where bodies of young males bearing wounds suggesting the same perpetrator had been discovered. This meeting concluded that the same individual had been murdered in each jurisdiction and that all involved in the investigation should form a unified task force dedicated to apprehending the suspect. The four separate murder investigations within Indiana were amalgamated into one, with investigators agreeing that this task force would comprise two detectives from the state police, two from the Indiana from the Indiana po from the I Indianapolis police, and two from each county involved in the manhunt. This task force, named the Central Indiana Multi-Agency Investigation Team, was commanded by Lieutenant Jerry Campbell of the Indianapolis Police. All information obtained was entered into a computerized database linked to the statewide police system. I'm going to do part two, 1 second.